So I saw my task this afternoon to kind of introduce the theme and go over a few things. And we're asking the question, healthcare reform, PPACA, I assume you all know what that is, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act versus single payer. And what I'm going to do is a very brief outline of recent U.S. healthcare reform, talk about some of the challenges facing our healthcare system, and then compare how a single payer model would deal with that with the ACA or PPACA. At the outset, you should know that I don't believe I have any relevant financial relationships with commercial interests, but as you have heard, I am the past president of Physicians for a National Health Program, although I never received any compensation from that organization. If anything, I've given to that organization. So President Obama was faced with a truly fateful choice, I think, at the outset of his presidency. He wanted to deal with health care reform, but he did not want to start from scratch. He had, I think, two fundamental choices. He could have decided to build on a public sector program like the Medicare program, or to build on the private sector like private health insurance. Which do you think he chose to do? To build predominantly on the private sector, right? Now, he was following in the tradition. Okay, so here we have the first sitting president who advocated national health insurance for the United States. Does anyone recognize him? Truman, right. Somebody of the appropriate age recognizing Harry Truman. Did he get national health insurance? No. And so it was left up to this president, LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, to pass a limited form of national health insurance essentially for the elderly, people over 65. And then in about 1971, this guy, who was then in the Senate, and I think you recognize him, Teddy Kennedy, proposed, let's take that Medicare program and spread it to the rest of the population. Well, the sitting president at that moment, you all recognize Richard Nixon, right, said, oh, no, we're not going to do that. And to counter the Kennedy proposal, he came up with the idea of an employer mandate. Let's insist that every employer offer health insurance. He didn't get that, so along comes Bill Clinton, and he proposes an individual mandate. And this is at the actual language in his bill. Some people don't recognize it, but it's a true individual mandate. But, of course, Clinton didn't get his plan, and so we ended up with Barack Obama proposing a combination of an employer and a individual mandate, but let's leaven the cake with a public option. You can choose to enroll in a new public plan. So what happened to that public option? Well, the original robust plan put forward in March of 2009 was open enrollment in the Medicare program for anyone who wants it. I don't like the Cornell, you know, employee program that I'm in. I could choose this new public option. It would have Medicare rates. That means, you know, Medicare is negotiated with every provider, doctor, hospital, nurse practitioner in the country. Doesn't have to go back and do that. And it wouldn't have to put aside reserves the way private health insurance companies do have to do, because it'd be backed by government. And along comes Lewin and Associates, owned by United Healthcare, I point out, and it estimates that 119 million people will choose this public option. You mean you don't have to be uninsured beforehand? How many uninsured people do we have? Roughly 50 million. So there are more than that, you know, twice that, that are people like me that might choose the public option rather than the plan that they presently have. So, the private health insurance industry freaks out, right? And they spend $1.2 billion on lobbying in 2009 alone. This is from the Center for Public Integrity. And what happens is that by the time the House produced its plan in November of 2009, there's very restricted enrollment. You definitely have to be uninsured before you could go into this public option. In fact, it's so restrictive that it's not going to be 50 million people that will enroll, but only 6 million people, according to the Congressional Budget Office, and it will have to negotiate rates and become self-sustaining. But even that is too much for the private health insurance industry, because the Senate plan passed December 24th, Christmas Eve of 2009, does not include a public option. Little wonder, because that bill is crafted by a staff member in the Finance Committee, Liz Fowler, the former vice president of WellPoint Insurance. And then, of course, we get PPACA March 23rd, 2010. Why was there such a gap? Well, usually when the two houses of Congress have a difference, one has a public option, the other doesn't, they go into conference, right? But in January of 2010, we had the election in Massachusetts of Scott Brown, and Obama lost the 60 votes he needed in the Senate to get something passed. So what he said is, let's just take the Senate plan, and since we still have Democrats in control of the House, we'll just have the House adopt the Senate plan. And that's what we got, PPACA. What was it and what is it? Frankly, a mandate model. Everyone is required to have health insurance or pay a penalty. What's the size of those penalties? Well, the individual mandate says that if you're a single person, it will be $695. If you are a family, $2,085. And yes, there is an employer mandate. If you employ more than 50 people, you will pay a penalty if you don't offer health insurance to those employees of $2,000 per employee per year. I argue that this was absolutely essential for the survival of the private health insurance industry. In 2009 alone, they lost 6.3 million subscribers. And if you look at the decade before that, they had lost 15 million enrollees. They had, frankly, a defective product, and increasing numbers of people were no longer buying into it. Well, what's the alternative? I would argue it's an improved Medicare for All, a single-payer model. Build on the original, you know, Medicare program, expand it to the entire population, improve its coverage because it has some real problems, include preventive services, dental care, long-term care, eliminate copays and deductibles, expand drug coverage so there would be no donut hole, and redesign physician reimbursement. So what are the challenges that these two programs would have to address? I would say it's these five things. We could expand them to more, but we don't really have time. So let's go with each of these and see how each of these solutions deal with those problems. Declining access. Here you see from 1976 to 2011, roughly a million more people become uninsured in the United States. Oh yes, a little dip here in the mid-1980s when Waxman got the Medicaid program to expand. A little dip here in the end of the 1990s when the state child health insurance program is created. And a little dip here in 2011 because of the coverage of 26-year-olds, up to 26-year-olds on their parents' policies. But it's pretty astounding. But that's only part of the problem. I believe there is an epidemic of underinsurance in the United States. And my definition is quite simple. If you spend more than 10% of your income in any one year on health care, you are underinsured. Look at this. In the year 2000, 42 million people experienced that problem. And they weren't just people who were uninsured. They were mostly people with insurance. And that number had gone up to over 62 million people in 2007. And the most recent data suggests that we are close to 80 million people who are, in fact, underinsured. Little wonder that 62% of personal bankruptcies in the United States are due to medical expenditures, and over 75% of those people had health insurance at the outset of their bankrupting illness. Why did they go bankrupt? Yes, because they were underinsured, but in addition, anybody guess? They got so sick, what happened to them? They lost their job. And what happens in the United States when you lose your job? You lose your health insurance, the only industrialized nation where that happens. So how does an improved Medicare for All deal with that problem? Well, I think the crucial words to look for in legislation is automatic enrollment. You present to the emergency room of a hospital. They do their wallet biopsy on you and find out you have no health insurance. What an opportunity. Let's sign you up for the National Health Insurance Program. You ought to be in it, right? Is there any private health insurance company that would sign you up in the emergency room of a hospital? No way, right? And this should be a federal guarantee. And probably the most controversial thing I'll say is that I think this should cover all residents of the United States. I mean, even the undocumented. Yes, we could put in law some rule about, 9 months or a year of residency that's documented so people don't just come to the United States for health care. But we should really cover the undocumented. Everybody in, nobody out. Well, what about PPACA? What does it do in terms of universal coverage? It mandates the purchase of health insurance. We talked about that. That, by the way, only goes into effect in 2014. But it does something else that's fairly significant, I think. It expands Medicaid eligibility up to 133% of the poverty level. And that is actually going to give access to a much larger group of potential beneficiaries than exists now. But that's not going to happen in every state because the Supreme Court said the feds can't force states to expand coverage. So we have Florida, Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, South Carolina, all of which the governors have said, we're not going to expand Medicaid. No way. Then it subsidizes premiums up to 400% of the poverty level, and you can see there we're getting to some respectable incomes, but we don't know how big that subsidy is going to be. That's not in the legislation. And yes, there's some good insurance market reforms in PPACA. Coverage up to age 26, no pre-existing condition exclusions, no annual or lifetime limits. But what's going to be the case by 2019? We're still, according to the Congressional Budget Office, going to have 23 million uninsured people, and they just redid their numbers. These numbers were in 2009. And we're going to have probably 30 million people still uninsured, and they're not just the undocumented, believe me. The undocumented are probably somewhere around 8 million. So this PPACA is not universal coverage. Well, what about costs? Well, look here. Here you see the costs of premiums from 1999 up to 2011. have gone up 160%. The employee contribution to those premiums has gone up 168%, but in the same time, workers' earnings have only gone up 50%, and inflation has taken away 38%. Little wonder that probably the most common reason that a union goes on strike, or threatens to do so, is when an employer tries to shift the cost of premiums onto employees. In fact, the cost of premiums has gotten so high that even the middle class would have difficulty paying for it. Here, average for employer-provided health insurance, $5,600 for singles, $15,745 for families. Well, how does a Medicare for All deal with this problem? One way is by having really low administrative costs because it's a single-payer program. Here, look at the Medicare program, 2 to 3% overhead. That means that 97 to 98% of the dollars collected by that program go to doctors and hospitals. Private insurance has an overhead anywhere between 16 and 30%. In this article in the New England Journal of Medicine, it is estimated that $400 billion could be redirected to cover everyone who is uninsured and everyone who is underinsured if we went from our for-profit multi-payer system to a single-payer system. And where does that money and savings come from? Yes, it costs more, as you can see here, to cover the uninsured and the poorly insured, to eliminate cost sharing and co-pays, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. But the savings come not only from the insurance industry itself, but from our adaptation to it. So there are hospital administrative costs that will go down. We compare Toronto General in single-payer Canada with the Mass General in Boston. Similarly sized hospital, three billers up in Toronto, over 300 billers at the Mass General. Little wonder that every bill that we have in Congress to go to single payer includes a jobs retraining component, because this is a serious problem. In my office, I would be able to employ certainly one less person who helps me deal with all those denials of claims, different prior approvals, and so forth. We could get into bulk purchasing of drugs and equipment. What entity in this country gets the lowest price for drugs? Is it Medicare? No, Medicare's not allowed to negotiate with the pharmaceutical industry. It turns out it's the Veterans Administration, because they are able to negotiate directly. And yes, we could have some real primary care emphasis. So here you can see we could actually save money by going to a single-payer program. And just to show, oh, I love this slide here. Look, this is the number of doctors and how they've increased since 1970. Look at what's happened to the number of administrators. We need to amputate that group. Give them meaningful work instead of denying claims and pushing papers, right? And just to show you, these numbers aren't just mine. This is from Carl Schramm, agrees about the overhead in Medicare, but says that commercial insurers have a 19.9% overhead and profit. That's what persuaded me he really was conservative. He wouldn't say 20%, right? So how does PPACA deal with the problem of cost? Well, essentially, it's a market theory. It mandates, essentially, the young and healthy uninsured to buy health insurance, right? There is that group of invincibles out there who don't think they're going to get sick, right? And the theory is that they don't buy health insurance, okay? And if we could force them to do that, they're not going to necessarily get sick, so they won't use as much resources, and premiums for everyone should go down. Well, will this really work? I just told you the premiums before. I told you what, in fact, the penalties were. I fear, frankly, that many, many people are going to say, well, I'll just take that penalty rather than buy the insurance. And I think even some employers are going to say, hey, it's a little bit cheaper for me not to offer health insurance and go ahead and just take the penalty. Yes, there are some unproven tools in PPACA to contain costs, health information technology, but frankly, it costs a lot to convert to computerized medical records, for instance, not just in terms of the machinery, but in terms of the training of providers. Chronic disease management, a great idea by Ed Wagner, but not submitted to any randomized trial. And then these payment reforms that you've heard a lot about, accountable care organizations, bundled payments, value-based purchasing, none of which have been submitted to a good randomized trial. So little wonder that the CMS actuary here comes out, and you can see the blue line, and estimates by 2019 we will be spending $4,700,000,000,000 on health care and be up to 21% of our gross domestic product. And all of those old folks who have tried to calculate differently don't get much lower numbers. Problem three, comprehensive benefits. Think of this both in terms of actual services like doctors, nurse practitioners, hospitals, drugs, and financial coverage, co-pays, and deductibles. I would advocate for, in fact, very comprehensive coverage, all medically necessary services. Would there be any exclusions? Like to keep them limited, but maybe tummy tucks, Botox for wrinkles, and maybe even private rooms in a hospital, unless medically necessary. I'm in a room with him. He's coughing away. The resident comes in and says, oh, I think, Steve, you might have tuberculosis. Get me out of his room. He has a medically necessary reason to have a private room. I would eliminate all co-pays and deductibles. They're the crudest tools to control demand. They reduce, in every study that's been done, needed care virtually equal to frivolous or unneeded care. And they result clearly in an underuse of primary care services. And frankly, they're not as effective even in reducing the use of high technology services. We can think of other ways to do this, such as really trying to eliminate self-referral to doctor-owned facilities. That's what made the costs in McAllen, Texas, so high in that Atul Gawande article. So how does PPACA deal with this comprehensiveness of benefit issues? Well, unfortunately, there is no standard benefit package. It eliminates copays and deductibles, but only on preventive services. And there's no regulation of the magnitude of premiums, deductibles, copays, just the stipulation that benefits must have, at minimum, a 60% actuarial value. That means that the patient will have to pay 40% of the cost of health care. And yet there's a stipulation that health insurers must have a medical loss ratio of 80 to 85%. You all know what a medical loss ratio is? This is that concept on the part of insurance companies that every dollar they spend on a doctor, hospital, or medication is, from the insurance company's perspective, a loss. A loss. I mean, that's phenomenal, right? They're supposed to be in the business, it seems to me, of helping us get care, but they're not. They're in the business of trying to restrict the care that we use. Well, so PPACA is not terribly good on comprehensiveness of benefits. Well, what about choice? That's why we need private health insurance, right? But already, without PPACA, 42% of employees in this country have no choice. Why is that? Anyone have a guess?
Higher
the employer offers only one plan. I don't call that choice, right? And frankly, most private health insurance limits your choice to a network of doctors and hospitals with whom the insurer has negotiated contracts. And if you go out of network, you have to pay substantially more. Private health insurance is not that helpful in terms of choice. Whereas an improved Medicare for all would expand choice for everybody. No limit to a network of providers. Free choice of doctor and hospital. We would finally be able to de-link health insurance from people's employment. Great thing, right? How does PPACA deal with this? Well, the creation of health insurance exchange. These exchanges, unfortunately, will only increase choice for some people. The enrollment in the exchanges is going to be limited to those within the individual and small group market. It will produce a marketplace, yes, of health insurance plans, which is probably a good thing if you have to have private health insurance, but there won't be any public option in that marketplace. They're going to be state-based, so there's not going to be a standard throughout the United States, and PPACA says no state single-payer plan can even be done until 2017. Well, don't tell that to the state of Vermont. They go ahead and elect in 2010 a governor who runs on a platform of single-payer. They hire Bill Schall, a Harvard economist. They decide to build on his idea of a public-private hybrid single-payer program, and then the legislature actually passes legislation for that direction. And finally, there is the challenge of how to pay for reform. How does an improved Medicare for All do that? Yes, it would use public funding. Okay, that's the important thing. It might use more of a graduated payroll tax. You know, right now, the Medicare program is financed by a flat tax, at least the Part A, right? So here we might increase the percentage that people contribute to the program as their income goes up. I think that's not a bad idea and one of the improvements we might make to the Medicare program. We could use some corporate and income taxes and even taxes on unearned income. The major thing is we've got to get away from premium financing, because what happens in premium financing is that the president of the company pays the same premium as the secretary in the company, but their incomes are so widely different. And we would argue there would be no increase in overall costs because of those administrative savings that we talked about earlier. This would all be delivered through a nonprofit private delivery system. This is not socialized medicine, let's face it. In fact, that's what I'm criticized frequently for. You know, people say you should be advocating a national health service. Well, this is not what we're advocating at this point. Doctors are not salaried by government. Hospitals would not be owned by government. That's socialized medicine. We have a little system within the country that is that. Anyone have a guess? The Veterans Administration, right, exactly. But the Medicare program is not that kind of program. It's publicly funded and a privately delivered partnership. How does PPACA finance itself? Well, ironically, it puts an excise tax on Cadillac health insurance plans. The Cornell students say, ah, you should say BMW, Dr. Fine. People don't know what a Cadillac is anymore. Right? But the idea is that the good comprehensive plan is going to be taxed so that employers are going to have an incentive not to offer good comprehensive plans. Yes, there is a payroll tax increase in PPACA for people of high incomes going from 145% up to 235%, and fascinatingly, a tax on investment income. Very rare to see that happen in this present Congress. And yes, some savings from Medicare, that have been, you know, broadcast and lampooned by the Romney folks. But a lot of that money is going to come from the Medicare Advantage program, which presently is getting overpaid by somewhere around 12 to 15%. If Advantage patients, those are people who have elected to use a private insurer, were in fact in the original or traditional Medicare program, the Medicare program would be spending 12 to 13, 14% less on those patients. Does that make sense? There's a cut in DSH payments. Those are the disproportionate share patients. A problem perhaps with our safety net institutions. We're going to hear about that. But the assumption is that more people are going to have health insurance. Therefore, safety net hospitals aren't going to have as many uninsured patients. Well, yes, there's a decrease in payments to doctors and hospitals, you know, and a cut in payments to nursing homes in PPACA. So, in summary, what do we get with the Affordable Care Act? Yeah, we get some expanded coverage, but it's not universal. 30 million still uninsured. Cost control by market means only. No definition of benefits. A risk of increasing underinsurance. Choice through state-based exchanges, but no public option. Primary care through ACO pilots, you know, and funding with an excise tax on high comprehensive private health insurance. What do you get with a Medicare for all approach? Universal coverage with automatic enrollment, low administrative costs because it's a single payer, comprehensive coverage without co-pays and deductibles, maximum choice of doctor, nurse practitioner, and hospital, improved quality through nationwide HIT, I haven't talked about that, expanded primary care, it's going to be publicly funded, privately delivered, Medicare 2.0. And yes, we have a bill in Congress, H.R. 676, Conyers' bill that essentially embodies this, Bernie Sanders' bill, Senate 519, again, essentially covering all those things. And, you know, when you go out there and you ask people what they like, okay, here's a New York Times, CBS News poll. Overall, do you think the benefits from government programs such as Social Security and Medicare are worth the cost of those programs for taxpayers? Or are they not worth the cost? In a national sample, 76% of Americans believe that is something they value. But the amazing thing is that 62% of self-identified Tea Party folks say the same thing, right? Absolutely amazing. So, in summary, a system based on private health insurance plans, I believe, will not lead to universal coverage, will not create affordable insurance. A Medicare for all system can lead to universal comprehensive coverage, has the greatest potential to increase choice, improve quality, and expand primary care, and can be financed fairly. What will happen if we don't really move to single payer? Well, here you can see the average household income, and here you can see the average cost of a health insurance premium. In 2038, they're going to intersect. Someone will have to spend their whole household income on health insurance premium, a condition not compatible with life. Finally, people always ask me, you know, at the end of this talk, well, do you think PPACA is a step forward or a step back? I would argue it's a kind of step sideways, but this is what's important in it. For the first time in U.S. history, our Congress, through PPACA, has stated that every citizen should have access to health care. That is significant, I think. So I like this paraphrase of the Martin Luther King phrase. The arc of history, namely the moral universe, the arc of history is long, but it bends, I believe, toward universal access to health care. He said, of course, it bends toward justice. But thank you very much.
we have one or two urgent questions before we go on to Dr. Fagan. Yes.
Yes, I have a question. I've got some friends, quite a few friends are in Massachusetts, and they seem to like the what's going on in Massachusetts with health care. And why are you so against the Affordable Care Act when presumably that's based on the what the philosophy was going on in Massachusetts?
Okay, well, I'm not sure I'm, you know, against the Affordable Care Act. I just feel we have to go beyond it. It is unfortunately, from a nationwide point of view, not going to solve the fundamental challenges we face. I hope I've demonstrated that. Also, by the way, I think it depends on who you talk to in the state of Massachusetts. For instance, and we'll hear about the safety net hospitals in Massachusetts, they are absolutely freaking out right now because they're very worried that they will in fact not have adequate resources to cover the population that needs them. So it's a very mixed bag, although it's true many people think it's great, but not everybody.
So actually that's a good segue to Dr. Fagan, but those of you that are standing in the back, I know it's against any decent student's belief, but there are seats here in the front if you want to relax and sit down. There's seats here in the front row over here. There's a bunch of seats over there. Yeah, so you can see where the hands are. Well, you're welcome to stand if you wish, but... So next we're going to ask Dr. Fagan to come and talk, as we sort of unpeel this onion. She's going to concentrate her remarks on the safety net. The medical safety net.
Okay, good afternoon. So my name is Claudia Fagan, and I'm an internist. I practice in Chicago. And I'm the chief medical officer of a little hospital called John Stroger Hospital of Cook County. So it's true that the Massachusetts plan is quite popular among individuals in Massachusetts. But while Ali might say that the Affordable Care Act is maybe one step sideways, I probably would say it's one step forward and two steps back. And the reason is it does provide some benefits for individuals. But I acknowledge that Cook County, we're an extreme case in terms of public hospitals in this country. But let me just tell you a little bit about my world, because 56% of the people sitting in beds in Cook County today are uninsured. And 80% of the people who we see as outpatients are uninsured. And, you know, clearly unfunded. And so when we talk about the impact or the implications of the Affordable Care Act, it is, you know, and by the way, I have a neighbor. I live in Hyde Park in Chicago. And less than two blocks from me, about a block and a half from me, is a gentleman by the name of Barack Obama who went to the White House. So this is, you know, I love Barack. I've known him for a long time. We know where he knows the right thing to do. He was a patient in the practice that I worked in before I went to work for the public sector. So he's well acquainted with the notion of single payer. So and what he did is beyond laudable. Because there's lots of literature written about the attempt to get universal health care in this country. I read a wonderful history called The Heart of Power, talking about going from Theodore Roosevelt through Bill Clinton in terms of their attempts to get universal health care. So the fact that he was able to navigate this piece of legislation through was no small feat. However, The question is, and I think Ali asked that question, is where do you get the money? And so we live in a time where people think that it should be a zero-sum game. So you get the money to provide coverage for individuals by taking it away from institutions. And so maybe you're saying that that's the way we should go, that we should go away from population-based funding to individual-based funding. But I would argue that there's some problems with that, in terms of what our expectations are. So the loss of direct funding for public hospitals or all, you know, and the safety net is not just public hospitals, but under the burden of, we have rampant profit-taking by what I, to paraphrase, the medical-industrial complex. And we have a political establishment that's focused on deficit reduction and that lacks the intestinal fortitude to acknowledge reality is that health care is underfunded in this country. So I would say with the implementation of the Romney Care Plan in Massachusetts, the safety net facilities experience increased demand for services, not decreased demand for services. And so when safety net facilities across the country see a decrease in the disproportionate share funding or the DSH funding, they're receiving this decrease because there's an assumption that more of the patients that they take care of will be insured. But there's nothing to suggest that the safety nets will be able to capture enough of those newly insured patients to meet their expenses. So, you know, the problem with the politics of deficit, you know, living in a time when everybody's focused on decreasing the deficit, it erodes the ability of local governments to support the safety nets. So, what am I talking about? As quiet as it's kept, public hospitals who are under the management of politically elected boards, you know, Cook County Hospital for many years was governed by the county board. And public hospitals under such a governance, while they suffer, I mean, tremendously under the political micromanagement, they become bastions of patronage. They have inability to hire the appropriately qualified individuals. However, they also reap the benefits of transfer of revenues, whether it's through property tax increases or sales tax increases. Those government boards found ways to increase the funding to those institutions. Or sometimes it was the assumption of benefit, pension benefits for individuals who work for those hospitals, or it was debt services, or providing administrative ways. In other words, there was a shifting of dollars on the books so that the public hospital's book did not really reflect the true expenses it took to run them. But now, when we have such debt, you know, everybody's focused on no new taxes and deficit reduction. And in county, we saw the rollback of a property tax increase that almost made us solvent. But our current president of the county board, as a part of her campaign, promised that she would roll back that tax. And then you're forced with, so where are you going to get the dollars from to support the activities of the institution? And this mood, this tenor of no new taxes and deficit reduction is across the country. So we see that with the decreasing of the DSH funding and the inability to look to local governments to find additional dollars, that safety nets are squeezed in terms of how they're going to operate. So what we see with the Affordable Care Act is a shift of funding to individual. So we see the expansion of Medicaid, which will be federally funded. Most people understand it. Medicare is a federally funded, federally mandated program, and Medicaid is a federally mandated but generally state-funded program. So we don't actually have one Medicaid program. What we have are 50 different Medicaid programs because each state, there's a ceiling, there's a floor that the federal government sets in terms of benefits you provide, but each state is different. And I happen to live in a state that tends to be in the lower 45, you know, the other 45 states tend to be above us in terms of the amount of benefit that we pay. But so there is, thank you. So there is the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act is going to be federally funded. So, you know, the states that Ollie points out said that they will not accept the expansion of Medicaid is rather disingenuous. We expect, regardless of the outcome of the election, those states will accept that expansion because it's, you know, it's like leaving cash laying on the ground in front of you and turning and walking the other way. We're talking about states that can't afford to provide care for their citizens. The other problem with the Affordable Care Act is that there are those people who will never be eligible or will not have access to care under this act, and they may crowd out the newly insured from the safety nets. In other words, those people who are, there will be people who will be eligible but not enrolled because they can't figure out the bureaucratic morass, they can't navigate their way through the system as we have now. There are those for whom private insurance is not affordable, either because they make too much to be eligible for Medicaid or not enough to afford private insurance, even with the subsidies provided by the government. Because even though we may say to people, based on your income, you should be able to buy a policy, doesn't mean that those folks can really make that work. We have all kinds of guidelines about how much you should spend on housing, how much you should spend on groceries, and how much you should spend on transportation, and yet people are not able to live within those means. So there are people who we know will not be insured, even with the potential of having subsidies to purchase private insurance. The undocumented are not eligible to be covered and will never be covered under this plan. And finally, there's a five-year waiting period for those who are documented. So if you're an immigrant and you're documented, you must wait 5 years before you can purchase insurance, and it's not as though you won't get sick in those 5 years. Unless you've got some way to guarantee that, then maybe we all should be drinking that. So the other notion about where do you get the cash from to pay for the Affordable Care Act is, you know, there's this huge drive for coordinated care. And I love this. It's a wonderful thing. So the idea is that if we had coordinated care, we'll drive down admissions and we'll drive down readmissions. So that, you know, care within the safety net is typically fragmented. There's often gaps in services. People tend to fall in and out of insurance coverage. And so by definition, with gaps in care, that's poor quality care. And it results in redundant services. So what am I talking about? I'm saying that, okay, so this person who came to see me last week, who had health insurance, had private insurance until she lost her job 6 months ago, has diabetes, and now she doesn't have insurance, and so I see her, and we start down a path to take care of her. And then she gets a job and says, oh, I can go back to my previous employer. And each time there's a fallout or a washout period. Did she keep the same medications? Did she see the same doctor? Did we have the same plan? Did we have an appointment for the mammogram? Okay, we're going to go get the mammogram over there. These gaps in services, or yes, I had this blood work done last weekend in the emergency room, but I can't see that emergency room. And I love this requirement for us to have electronic medical records, and none of them talk to each other. Let me just tell you, in Chicago, we have Northwestern Hospital, Cook County Hospital, the University of Illinois Hospital. I'm thinking there's another one. We're all using Cerner, which is a common large company that provides the software for the electronic medical records, and none of them talk to each other. We have different versions of the same electronic medical records that are not exchangeable. So you have to repeat the test. So you had a CT scan, but we don't have that CT scan, and we need to figure out what's going on, so we repeat the test. So by definition, care within the safety net is fragmented and poor quality. So the notion that we could provide coordinated services with wraparound care, case management, social work, dietary counseling, patient education, and pharmacy review of medications, increased primary care, this is a wonderful life. Because these patients with chronic illnesses and chronic diseases will have fewer admissions to the hospital. We'll be less likely to be readmitted. There's nothing in the act to pay for that. We have to figure that out, because we have to figure out how to pay for those services, to provide those services to patients. And the problem here is that if you're dealing with a safety net system that has inadequate capacity for the uninsured, those admissions that you don't have because of those people who have coordinated care, those beds will be filled by those other patients who couldn't get coordinated care and who do keep coming back into the hospital. So what I'm trying to point out is that in an idealized world, in theory, this works. This makes everything better. But welcome to my world, where every morning between 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, people start lining up to be seen in our walk-in clinic. And by 10 a.m., we have maxed out in terms of how many people we'll be able to see today. So whether it's 250 or 500 people we see, and it can be usually fluctuate between 250 and 400 patients that we'll see, you know, so the person who doesn't get seen today because we've maxed out, this is the walk-in clinic where you come where you don't have a doctor and you decide today's the day, today I'm going to go get seen and get plugged into the county system. So when you get turned away at 10 o'clock in the morning, you may say, okay, tomorrow I'm coming back, but I'm coming earlier. Or maybe it's not that important and I'll come back next week, next month, next year, or maybe when you come to the emergency room. So what we're looking at for the safety net is a loss of continuity of care for our patients. By definition, increasing primary care use will decrease unnecessary admissions and will improve the quality of care. But the Affordable Care Act does not provide any guarantees that we can provide those services for our patients. So my concern is that what we've done is that we had a zero-sum game in terms of how many dollars we were going to spend, and what we decided to do was we're giving the money to individual patients instead of the institutions that have been taking care of those patients, and told those institutions, improve your service, improve the quality of care, and you will attract those patients who have insurance and be able to survive with funding. At the same time, there's a pool of patients who have nowhere else to go and no potential of being enrolled, who you've made no provisions for, and you expect them to go where to get care. So, yes, there is no question that it was a laudable thing to navigate through Congress an act that on its premise is that health care should be guaranteed for all. When they started with this bill, they said that the number of people who would be left uninsured would be 23 million. Right? Was that the original?
Yep.
And we're now to 30?
Yep.
And where do you think we'll be in 2019? I would say to you, if you are involved in the care of patients in any way, that's not okay. That's not okay. And Ali is absolutely right. How dare us say that people who are immigrants are not entitled to health care in this country? Because who in this room is not the descendant of an immigrant? There may be a few Native Americans, but if they're not, nobody. So my question is, why is it okay to say, I don't know if anybody, has anybody gone out to dinner while they've been here? Not yet? Okay, San Francisco? Look in the kitchen. Who prepared the food? Who washed the dishes? You know, now I happen to be, you know, both my parents are immigrants. I'm the first generation for our family born in this country. But the idea that we would construct a system, construct a plan and say we've covered everybody, we spend more money in this country trying to keep or prevent people from getting care that could be used for delivering care. And so the Affordable Care Act, in a concept, is a good idea, but as far as the safety nets are concerned, it's going to make it that much harder for us to do our jobs. And the last time I saw, nobody was telling us to go away because nobody else wants to take care of those patients. So my neighbor knows this. Every time that I see him, I don't miss a chance to remind him. Don't see him as much as we used to. But I think that the American public has to say that, but we need more. And I'll stop there.
Yeah. A burning question here. Okay.
I think what we need is an outbreak of multi-drug resistant TB among the undocumented, uninsurable, to spread it to everybody else by coughing on them in the ball, and then we'll get the motivation to do these things.
There you go. Thank
you. You know, Larry Wallach was speaking yesterday at a memorial service for Rick Brown, and he's always very insightful. I was like listening to Larry. But he had a quote that I want to start off with from Gravity's Rainbow, a book. And the quote is, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they do not have to worry about the answers. If they can get you asking the wrong questions, they do not have to worry about the answers. So I would suggest to you, I'm going to try and address your question, even though it's an important question, that the question of whether the Affordable Care Act is a step backward or forward is the wrong question. In fact, the things that we talk about and have been talking about for 100 years, most of the time, in health reform, not all the time, but most of the time, have been the wrong questions. Now, it's not that they're unimportant questions. So let me start off by saying, I like Ollie and Claudia, I am a general internist. And the best part of my week is practicing clinical medicine. However, I want to be clear that creating a high-quality medical care system, which is something we don't have in this country, I think personally is critically important. I'm a little biased, okay? So I don't want to demean any of those debates, and I'll mention some of them as I go through my talk. So fee-for-service destroys good practice of medicine. Okay. Healthcare premium undermines the whole basis of the practice of medicine. But those are not the real critical questions. We are, and as I get older, I just get so frustrated. We are now being told that the new patient-centered medical home will save money and improve quality. Now, there are enough gray hairs in this room to know that the patient-centered medical home is a step backwards. All you young people that think it's a step forward, it may be an improvement over what most goes on in most doctors' offices, don't get me wrong, but it's a step backwards for us as a field. Patient-centered medical home, let me just read this. Patient-centeredness refers to an ongoing active partnership with a personal primary physician who leads a team, let me be clear, a physician who leads a team of professionals dedicated to providing proactive, preventive, and chronic care management through all stages of life. That's a little more progressive than some statements because it comes from the family practitioners, so they at least understand stages of life and the like. We've been talking about this for decades. Do people remember patient care teams? Do people remember interdisciplinary teams? Do people remember transdisciplinary teams? So even the concept that we're using today to suggest that we can work on health reform writ large in terms of how we restructure the practice of medicine are, frankly, backward notions that we know have failed and that other major industrialized countries do not talk about. Older concepts, and none of these are perfect, I'm not sure, even community-oriented primary care, people remember that, which was at least an attempt, and it's an American, we Americans are out of it. In most of the world, primary care meant community-oriented, but I'll leave that alone. but at least that was an attempt to think about populations and interventions beyond what happens in the exam room, in addition to good clinical personal health delivery services. So, the reality is that if we ask ourselves, what's the real goal of health reform? All those presidents that we saw, what were they really trying to do? They weren't trying to bend the cost curve. That's why Americans, when we think about how come this debate is so confusing to them, what does that mean, bend the cost curve? What does it mean? Quality, we have to balance quality and cost. We twist ourselves in knots. Most people have on, at their gut level, they think, well, most people deserve to be healthy. And they need to have nice lives and be well and happy. I mean, that's not complicated. My grandchild can understand that. Okay? And when we stray away from that question, because the real question is, how do we have a healthy nation and a healthy world. But let's just concentrate on, because we're really sick in this country, so let's just concentrate on the critical patient for the moment. How do we have a healthy nation? What do we need to do that? we do need to fix our medical care system. Now, this is an APHA, so let me just say, and you know, I've already been to many meetings where we're debating, oh, what are we going to do about public health, and what about the funding of public health, and how do we get under the shadow of medical care? This is like a, you know, an annual thing we do, right? It's like a therapy session or something. It's almost as though we in this country think of ourselves as Siamese twins, you know, the medical care system and the public health system, except we're sort of like the dwarf twin that, you know, where the, you know, where the, it doesn't, the, you know how that works sometimes. And we debate. We ask the wrong questions, too. How can we get some of the food that the big fat twin is getting? Maybe we should put an IV line here, over here, and we could do something. And then we have absurd discussions. Maybe we should just undertake the surgical risk of separating, which, you know, sometimes can kill you. You know, should we do that or not? Will we survive that or not? When really the problem is the big fat twin is sick. So when we think about health services in the narrow sense, we have to fix both. It's not a one or the other thing. It's not preventive health versus clinical medicine. It's not population health versus individual health. I have my biases, which I know you may suspect what they are, but the reality is, if you don't have a healthy public health system, you can't have a healthy clinical system. And if you don't have a healthy clinical system, you can't have a healthy public health population-based system. And so our real question has to be, how do we make both systems well? So that's one minor question. It's not the major question. It doesn't answer the question of how do we keep people that live in this country healthy. This year in Public Health Week, we're going to have our theme. I don't like this theme. I'm just going to tell you right now. It's going to be Public Health ROI, which stands for Return on Investment. Because the notion is, if we want to have if we want to engage in discussion with people that control things in this country, we have to sort of talk their language. That's the reason for it. I mean, it's not a bad notion, but what really distresses me is I'm not sure what that means, ROI. Do we really save money in the short run? I don't know what the short run is. I'm not convinced that if we invested the way we were supposed to, that we would save money on the bottom line for a century. Well, maybe you all think you have different math. But I know we wouldn't save money in 10 years or 20 years or 30 years. So we ask the wrong questions. And what really is distressing is that we think the wrong way. It would be different if I was having a discussion with a businessman or a politician, like, say, my mayor, Mr. Emanuel. Now, you know, I have to be careful how I speak to him, because his ability to understand things is limited. So I wouldn't talk to him the same way I'm talking to you. And so I recognize that, you know, you have to go into meetings, you have to go to Congress, you have to go to your state legislature, and you have to speak in a language that they can understand. You may have to have a bill. You can't go in there with a bill that says, we want all Americans to be healthy and well and happy. You know, that's not going to fly as legislative language. But if you don't understand yourself that that's what you're doing, then you're in real trouble. Let's look at some basic things where we've invested billions of dollars in health information exchanges. Now, Claudia will tell you, I love gadgets. Right?
Yeah.
I am not gadget phobic. Okay? But I'm here to tell you, EMRs are not ready for prime time yet. And how we think about them is too narrow. Not only do the Cerner products in Chicago don't talk to each other, the health information exchanges, 99% of them, are not even asking the right question. Wouldn't it be great to not only know what Northwestern's x-ray might show, wouldn't it be great to know what the unemployment rate is in the neighborhood where my patient is from? How many assaults there were on the street before I tell them to go for a walk? What the air pollution and quality was at the playground, whether there was lead in the soil of the community garden, okay, what the tax rate was, what's the median income. So as public health people, we have data that we don't even know how to ask a question about. My mantra is, what would Google do? Google knows what I'm going to search for before I do. And they're right 98% of the time. What would they do if their mission was to make everyone in this country healthy, well, and happy? What information would they use to do that? We're not asking those questions. We know what determines people's health. I think the evidence is overwhelming. We can quibble about the various impacts of this factor or that factor. I'm not saying we all agree right down to the letter, but in general, we agree around the world about what makes people healthy or not healthy. We understand that there's an interaction between the individual focus and the population focus, and that what we talk about as social determinants of health are really the things that produce health or ill health. And while I don't want to completely endorse the WHO Closing the Gap report, because I have some criticisms of it from the left, but if the United States adopted that as a basic notion, I would be ecstatic. But I do think that they lay out a consensus of where public health is in the world. These are not influences on health. They determine what makes people healthy and what makes people ill. And central to that is power. And I don't care how many studies we have or didn't have, if people in this country that go to work every day and get sick every day had power, we would have universal health coverage. If those people had power, the rules and laws about the labor market would be different. It's not an accident that we're in such trouble and we're worrying about this Republican Heritage Foundation strange hybrid bill that Nixon would have thought was too conservative. Think about that. We're here debating, is it a step forward or is it a step backward? You know, we wouldn't be debating this if the number of workers in this country in the private sector that were unionized was above 10%, because it's below 10%. Part of the reason, not the only reason, but part of the reason the public sector workers are under attack is because the unionization rate there is 30%. What does it mean when we declare, a few years ago during H1N1, a worldwide pandemic, declare a national public health emergency in the United States of America, stand here on our pompous platforms as public health people and tell people, wash your hands, cover your cough, stay home if you're sick? And most workers in this country, when they stay home when they're sick, they don't get paid. Where is the basic social policy that says sick days are mandatory? This is part of what human beings need as basic essential things to survive. That's a health issue. Where is the structure and laws that say that class, race, and gender should no longer in this country determine how we divide up resources? No, we're trying to tell each other that we're post-racial because of brothers in the White House. What does it mean on return on investment when my mayor tells the president of the teachers union 25% of the children that go to public schools in Chicago are never going to make it? We don't want to waste any money on that 25%. We're asking the wrong questions. It's not about bending the cost curve. We already spend, you could saw the graphs, more money on medical care than any other country in the world, with horrible outcomes. It's not like we're afraid to spend money. It's what we're spending money on and who benefits from spending that money. That's really what we're talking about. Health reform would require changing fundamentally our rules and regulations about workplace health and safety. How can we send people to work? Poison them. We know it. When the job creators decide they're going to build a skyscraper, they figure into the cost of that. Steel is X amount of dollars. Gas is X amount of dollars. Bolts is X amount of dollars. Five workers will die in this. That's X amount of dollars. They know. They know, based on how high the building is going to be, how big the operation is, how many workers they're going to kill in the construction of that high rise. And we think that's a perfectly reasonable way to do business. And we sit up there and ask questions about, well, how can we get it from five workers to four or three and a half? We allow people to work in this country every day, 40 hours a week, and not make enough to feed their family or pay the rent. There are ways to prevent that. Not just minimum wage, guaranteed income. There are methods that have been used around the world. This is what determines whether people are healthy or not. We have a debate in this country about retirement and retirement benefits. The same debate's going on in Europe. You can see it now. Except it's interesting. In Europe, when they talk about change, taking away these benefits, they shut the whole city down. You know, Greece, you know. Most young people don't even know what a retirement plan is. They think it's a 401k, which is like a lottery system. Oh, that's what it is. So I would suggest to you that unless we are able to really ask the important, critical questions, we won't be able to construct the tactical discussions that we need around specific pieces of legislation. Because we do have to come back to that. I'm not trying to demean that. But if you don't have a broader context in which to think about how you keep people healthy, then the question of what the Affordable Care Act is going to do becomes the wrong question. It would be different if we had something that tried to reform how we finance medical care, which is what our health reform debate is about. It's not really about health care. It's about how do we finance medical care. And sometimes, if they're in a good mood, some population-based services. How do we finance how healthcare services? Which is an important question. But if that's all you're talking about, and you're not talking about how do we address public education in this country? Why is it more and more difficult for people to go to higher education? Why should they have to go and hock for that? How do we create meaningful, fulfilling jobs in this country? How do we guarantee safe and secure retirement? Not where you can avoid eating dog food, but where you actually can enjoy your grandchildren and travel and do all those other things. How do we do those things? If we don't have a plan to reform the healthcare system writ small with the public education, the housing, the transportation, you name the different sectors. And therein, I think, lies the real rub that we come up against. Larry Wallet talked about this also, but it's something that is going on in the national debates. Are we going to allow the country to pretend that everybody is an island and an individual and that everything that happens to you is your personal responsibility, which the evidence is clear is not true? Are we going to be clear on the truth that we really are all in this together? And that when we ask the questions for all of us and insist on answers that make sense and allow us to live as human beings, then the important, because we're so backwards, but still relatively minor question of how we structure our medical care system falls into place. So I think the Affordable Care Act, unfortunately, will fail. I don't even think it's a reform. It is particularly good. I do think it's an amazing feat that it got passed. And I, like you, spent a lot of energy trying to make sure that it was better than it turned out to be. That's not, that has nothing to do with our effort that we put into it. So I'm not criticizing people that spent hours and hours and hours trying to make sure that certain critical things got in. But we have to ask ourselves, do we really think 10 years from now or 15 years from now or 20 years from now, what will happen with this bill will be what was predicted when it passed? I don't think very many people in this room think that. And we can't afford to sit around and watch that happen. What we have to do is seize this as a weapon and say, this is what we got now. It's better than what we used to have. And here are things we need to do to make it better. And here are other set of things that we need to do to make sure people are healthy. So let me stop there so we can have some time for some interaction of questions and arguments. Yes. Speak up so people can hear you.
Really interesting for me to hear you. I am not American, I am Mexican. And I teach economics and health for my students in Mexico. I'm an attorney too. And I have always questioned myself, and my students make this question to me constantly. Why does America so afraid of social medicine? Can anybody answer me that? I mean, is that so bad? I mean, I know your conception of self-being and protection of the individual is so important, but as well, is that too bad to care about the rest?
Well, let me turn that. She's asking, and I'm going to ask anyone in the audience wants to stand up and say, why are Americans so afraid of social medicine? I'm not a psychiatrist, so I don't feel confident to answer that, but go ahead.
I'm not a psychiatrist either. I'm a pediatrician, although sometimes I'm a psychiatrist for the parents. I think in this country there's been two currents of philosophy since its founding, Hamilton and Jefferson. Jefferson, that government is best which governs least. Hamiltonian thinking, that government, we need that big, strong government to get the things done that we need to do. And in terms of health, government's role in healthcare, if you look at American history, in 1798, the Congress had an argument about whether or not to fund merchant marine sailors to have healthcare. The country was young at that time, you depended on the merchant marine for our commerce. They don't take care of sailors, they got sick. They just didn't get venereal disease. They got other things too. And so there was a big argument between the liberals and the conservatives in the Congress, and the liberals and the progressives won, and a hospital was built in Bethesda, Maryland for sailors. That now has grown into the National Institutes of Health. After that, there was an argument about whether or not the swamps should be drained around Washington, D.C., because they were full of malaria and yellow fever. The conservatives and the liberals got into an argument about that. Guess who won? Swamps were drained. Washington was able, the government was able to be established. In the 19th century, we had a long struggle around health, public health reforms, water, sanitation. People in this room know all about that. All right? There was constant arguments at the county, state, and federal level on improving public health for people. That the progressives basically won, and the population's health moved forward. In the 20th century, there was an argument in 1927 about whether or not the Maternal Child Health Act would pass. That failed largely because of the AMA's action against the progressives. The pediatricians were disgusted, quit the AMA, and founded the American Academy of Pediatrics. That was the founding of that. But after that,
so,
hey,
the point is that this is a long thing that's been going on. We're part of that stream of history. This latest struggle is part of that stream of history. There's a lot of people who thought like us, who came before us, who were able to fight for it and win. And this is all part of that. I think we should feel positive about it. And that answers your question about why the U.S. does this.
What he said, let me just quickly summarize, what he's pointing out, which is true, and let me, you know, really, if there's one thing you do after this meeting, you should go home and read some history. He's just pointing out these historical battles over time around these two basic concepts. What's the role of government, and what's the role of individuals? That's really the point he's making, except he made excellent examples in the history of healthcare. Yes.
Okay, I am a psychiatrist.
Oh, okay. Since you're close. quote. Why don't you go ahead and use that so people can...
Okay, the majority of Americans are not afraid of social insurance for health care. The problem is that there's a significant industry which is basically parasitic to health care that's sucking large amounts of money out of it, that does not want that funding stream stopped, and they're feeding a bunch of it back to the politicians. That's why we have this situation. It's not a matter of the population generally being afraid of socialized health care.
I can tell you, back in Mexico,
in fact, why don't you, if I could ask people to come up here, because this is a funny room and it's hard to see and it's hard to hear.
Well, you can
okay.
see me anyway.
Okay.
In Mexico, we do have combined systems. We do have private systems and we do have a social system. I can tell you it's not perfect. Your proposal of the Medicare may work. It sounds like the Mexican Institution of Social Security where I work. It's like it. And I can tell you, it has its flaws, a lot of flaws. Also, we have a public system where we can help the poor people. Now, it's called the social insurance, mm-hmm. but it still doesn't cover all the people. And we do have those parasites, sorry, companies, private companies. And what happens is when a patient runs out of money on coverage, they run to the IMSS, they run to the Mexican security system. Why? Because they have an insufficiency of money.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, cardiac insufficiency or cardiac right now is money insufficiency. So I think, but at least our people can get some medical attention. And I can tell you, I received back, I'm an internist too, as you are. I received back many patients, those immigrants, when they run out of job here, they go back to Mexico and get what they do. They made fraud and they get into the in Mexican institution so they can get covered because they have hemodialysis, they have a lot of things that couldn't be solved here, or injuries that were done while they were working here,
right.
And they go back to my system, and my system is exploding right now. We don't have enough money to cover all those patients who are going back. So that is an example. I mean, I do fight for social systems, but still I have to acknowledge they have flaws. So I'm really curious to see the future of America. How are you going to mix, how are you going to put together primary care with public health with this act? Really, I pay for see that. I'm just making my bet. Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Joyce, please come up. Other questions or comments? We have a lot of wisdom in the room.
You know it's going to be a comment. I just couldn't resist, obviously, to talk about the fact that we did move in the direction of marrying public health and primary care in the neighborhood health center movement that Jack Geiger started in Mississippi and wrote prescriptions for food. And in Chicago, we did do a study that on healthcare needs, and it included analyzing the communities based on housing, educational level, mm-hmm. and health level, infant mortality, and I'm sure that's in the library there still. So don't give up on us. The question is, why have we not been able to push that forward? We had a good start. We had dreams of moving it, and we couldn't move it all the way. There are lots of, obviously, political answers to that question, so maybe I'll drop that and just ask, what can we do now to move it forward? I think we do owe it debt to Obama for what he did accomplish. We all regretted that he dropped the public option, but I think he didn't have much of a choice. Maybe the first step would be to try to amend the Affordable Care Act to add a public option, because over time, the public option would prove to be the only one that's viable. Maybe that's a tactical approach. I put that forward too.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? People can... Yeah, yes. You're welcome to come up here if you want.
Just to let you know that the reason I've got this cane here is because I had a bicycle accident. I was trying to stay healthy. ended up fracturing my hip, my elbow, my shoulder. But at any rate, my basic feeling is that all of these plans of how to, you know, save our healthcare system here are doomed to failure unless we make some fundamental changes in the way that we look at the underpinnings of our health, which starts with good nutrition. And we have some information and very good data on what is how to eat healthfully, but the problem is that it's been hidden and overwhelmed by the information from the food industry that wants to keep feeding us all this unhealthy food and not have us eat well. And until we make some basic changes in those types of things, that we get accurate information to the people so that they can make some good decisions on how to keep themselves well and healthy, that we're not going to be able to handle these epidemics we have of diabetes and heart disease and cancer and all that. But that to me is kind of fundamental, so that prevention to me is probably the most important aspect of what we're doing now, and without it, everything else is going to fail.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Dr. Fine and Dr. Fagan to have an opportunity to make some summary comments, because I know everybody's schedule's tight. Ali?
I just wanted to say, with all very deep and due respect for Joyce Lassoff, I really worry about the public option and feel that we need, both as public health and as medical folks, to continue to have that vision for a really single-payer national health insurance program. The problem with the public option is that I fear that if we got that, it would be competing with the private health insurance industry, and we know how diabolical that industry is, right? It would try to recruit the healthy, it would make the public option more expensive, it would ultimately be a situation where the public option, would look like it was failing. So we need, I think it's really important for public health people and for medical people and nurse practitioner people to say we really want to see a Medicare for All improved, no doubt, expanded program. That vision is important. If we can't say that to the public, I don't know that they have any reason to believe that we could move in that direction. And I know that there is this big doubt about the political feasibility because of the corporate forces in our country, because of Citizens United and all of that. But I appeal to you, if you in fact were in the United States in 1859 and someone told you that slavery was going to end in 2 years, you would have said, politically unfeasible. That was the basis of the economics of the whole South of the United States. No chance it was going to go away. No chance that it was going to, to disappear in 2 years. Well, it did. And I think it's that kind of vision that we have to have. Healthcare for All is, I think, the civil rights issue of the 21st century for this country. And we've got to believe in that, and I think we'll be surprised that it may actually happen in our lifetime.
Yeah, so I would say that this would be the first step, and I would remind you that, as Linda alluded to, so single payer would be the first step because it would provide people with access to medical care, but our biggest challenge is that it's only a financial conduit, and the way we think about, it will allow us to pay for the care. But the bigger issue for us is we have to throw out the way in which we think about medical care in this country. And that until we start thinking about how we take care of people and thinking about the other bigger influences on the health of the nation. In other words, if people don't have safe housing and safe food to eat and don't have decent public transportation, then little else matters. But we have to start somewhere, so that would be where I would start. We have to begin to take care of the population, and we haven't even begun to think of that. So we have to tell our legislators that they have not served us well, and we expect more. And if we can't get more, then we can find somebody else who would serve us better. Thank you.
I want to thank everyone for coming. I just want to make one last comment. January 1st, 2013 will mark the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. And while that proclamation led the way for the amendment that ended chattel slavery, I stand before you today as a black woman and tell you after 150 years, we're still in trouble. I don't want us to be sitting, our people in the future, 150 years from now, sitting in a room like this, 150 years after the Affordable Care Act, and be talking about we still need universal health care. And we can make that sure that that doesn't happen. Thanks for coming.